Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. In 2017, MassMoCA became the largest museum for contemporary art in the world. But just three decades before, its vast brick buildings were the abandoned remains of a shuttered factory. Jennifer Traynor's new documentary film, Museum Town, tells the story. Museum Town shows how a small rural Massachusetts town went from economic collapse to art mecca. The film will be this year's closing night film at the Berkshire International Film Festival, screening at 7 p.m. at the Mehewi in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. An early and longtime director of development and public relations for MassMoCA, Jennifer Traynor is now the president and CEO of Hancock Shaker Village in Pittsfield. Museum Town is her first movie, and she joins us now to talk about it. Jennifer, welcome back to the Roundtable.
Thank you so much.
Tell me when you started working on the film and how you knew you wanted to make it.
During my years at MassMoCA, Rachel Chanoff and I would lead donor trips to the Sundance Film Festival, and we'd watch, you know, it'd be an intense 3 or 4 days where we'd watch two or three films a day. And it was in 2008, after we'd had three wonderful days of seeing a lot of films, many of which were documentaries, that I turned to her and I said, I want to make the film about MassMoCA. And she turned to me and she said, I'll produce it. And that was only 9 years after MassMoCA opened, and for a number of reasons, the timing just wasn't right. But as MassMoCA has grown into young adulthood, the time seemed right 3 years ago, and fortunately, Rachel signed on as my producer.
She did, and you got, it looks like, from watching the movie, cooperation from very many people involved, because you're able to even watch as Nick Cave and the team of assemblers and workers at MassMoCA make his big show, Until, which was on display 2 summers ago. How did you gain that access and make sure that you were observing and documenting, but not interfering in what's quite a big process?
Yeah, when I started the film, I wanted to tell the story in a unique way, and I wanted to tell the roller coaster ride of the evolution of MassMoCA, but I also wanted to express what MassMoCA is like today. And so I decided to do that by several parallel tracks, and one was telling the history. One was telling the story of MassMoCA through unsuspecting characters. And one was to follow an artist on his massive, or her massive, installation in Building 5, which is the largest gallery there that is the size of a football field. And I got lucky. The timing was completely coincidental. You know, the museum had just finished a very beautiful, pristine Richard Nonis installation, which was quite minimal and would not have been very interesting to cover in its installation, and was just embarking on this huge, complicated, colorful, dramatic work Until. And Nick was, I was a first-time filmmaker. He took a risk by allowing me full access, and I'm forever grateful. And, for example, I was able to be there the day in January that he walked into Building 5. It had been cleared out of the previous show. The elevator doors open. You can sort of hear the thud of the elevator door. There's complete silence as he takes in just how vast this project is going to be. And he says, oh, my God. And I felt so lucky to be there. And then, of course, it was fascinating because he worked closely with the fabrication team who in the basement were actually welding and doing all this work. And so by just becoming a fly on the wall, we were able to really show what it takes to actually realize one of these projects. And I must say, having worked at MassMoCA for 28 years, I had never spent a lot of time in the fabrication plant. And so it was really revealing to me personally as well.
There, yeah, I was thinking that, not having spent nearly as much time at the museum as you have, of course, but attending frequently, how much I didn't understand or didn't realize, and even like how many staff members there are that I've never met before.
Right, right. And, you know, I really wanted to show how with contemporary art and how with site-specific installations, it really is a team effort. It's a collaboration in the workshop between the artist and the welders, the painters, all that entire crew. And his work on Till was really an ideal ideal installation to follow.
And he's such a wonderful speaker with such a wonderful voice. And you you mentioned a moment ago other sort of characters that bring the story out and help tell the full story of the space and the place and the museum. And one of those is, of course, the late Ruth Yarder. Would you tell us a little bit about her?
Oh, she was, oh my word, she was such a gem. I knew I wanted a character who represented, you know, an artist, and that was Nick. And I knew I wanted somebody who actually did a lot of the physical work of the installations, and that was the head of fabrication, Richard Criddle. And I knew that the buildings I was going to treat as a character, because the 28 buildings on 13 acres, they inform everything the museum does. They're willful. You know, there are very few museums where you have so many windows in a gallery or odd corners. They aren't white boxes. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted somebody from North Adams. And I interviewed a few people, and then I met Ruth. And she worked at Sprague Electric for 43 years. She started right at the beginning of World War II. She was a junior at Drury High School, which is a public high school in North Adams. And she told the story of how Mr. Sprague came over to Drury, and if your grades were up, they would let you get out of high school early to go work at Sprague Electric, because there were 4,000 factory workers and all the men had gone off to war. And I ended up not using it, but she had this hilarious line where she said, you know, dear, in those days, an interview was high heels, white gloves, and a hat. And after Sprague closed, she became a volunteer at the museum. She was a ticket taker. And we followed her, and she showed us where her office was. She had not been back since Sprague had closed in the mid-1980s. And lo and behold, it was the bar at Bright
right.
Ideas it's, Brewing.
Yeah, that's so funny.
And you can't make those things up. So she's sitting in the bar having a root beer with her little pillbox hat on, talking about how the filing cabinets were over where the taps are. And she was great.
Yes, and she has so many fantastic stories that she tells throughout the movie, and she tells them so, so well.
Yeah, she was nonplussed. That opening line with her, when I ask her what she thought about contemporary art when she in Mass MoCA when she first heard about it, I knew from the beginning that she was not affected by the camera. She was sharp as a tack, and she was keenly observant and very forward-thinking. And a lovely woman, and hilarious. So what more could you ask for in a character?
Another important part of the film is the music. Tell us about working with John Stewart and Paul Pilot on the music. There's original music, and the soundtrack is very beautifully curated.
Oh, my word. I got so lucky with that. I knew a few things going into making the film. I knew that I wanted it to have a great soundtrack. And I love films where it's so good that you want to dance in your seat in the theater and you want to leave the theater dancing in the aisle. And I also knew that Mass MoCA is more than just a contemporary art museum. The performing arts are half of the program, so I wanted to bring that out, and I wanted to feature artists who had performed at Mass MoCA. And John Sturrett, who is the bassist with Wilco, he got it immediately. And there are a lot of cues. I think he told me there were 70 cues that he had to work on, and it's so beautiful. He dug deep with a lot of indie rockers. Like, there's this, the opening song is Objects by Big Thief, which is just exquisite. The last song in the film is Wilda Woman by Lucius. When they performed, I think their first performance was the second Solid Sound. They were completely unknown. And they now, of course, are, you know, attracting thousands at their performances. So we have two songs by them, but there are also songs by The War on Drugs, and we had a lot of fun putting together the soundtrack. And then he and Michael Jordanson did some beautiful compositions of original work for the film.
This is your first film, and it's about a subject you're very, very close to. Do you think that you will make another movie about something else you're close to or something else entirely?
You know, when I was making the film, I got a lot of raised eyebrows. You know, this is your first film was the question. If they were candid, usually they were nicer than that. But there was a lot of skepticism. And I just steeled myself that everybody has to have a first of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot. I worked with several cinematographers. You know, we had drone footage, which is a specialty of one. But K.J. Johnson is this beautiful cinematographer that, you know, she won an Oscar for Citizen Four. And she signed on really early. And she, in many ways, I feel like she mentored me. She did Camera Person, and she's a wonderful cinematographer. So it was a really hard, rich experience. I loved it. It was sort of ironic to me as I watched Nick Cave putting together Until and realizing that we were doing the same thing, because it was this team of a sound man and a camera person and me and our producers, and we were like one unit just moving through this 3-year process. I loved it. If I had 9 lives, I might, but right now I also have my hands full directing Hancock Shaker Village.
Of course.
But it was one of the highlights of my life, I would say. It was so much fun.
Was there, you mentioned just a line of Ruth's that you didn't get to use. Was there a lot of things, a lot of footage or a lot of interview subject matter or even archival stuff that you wish you could have included that didn't make the final cut?
Yes. One thing that KJ said to me at the very beginning, which I think can apply to life, but it was particularly true in making a film, was that she said, make a list of everything you want in this film and then divide it into necessary and obligations and be prepared to leave the obligations on the cutting room floor. I mean, there were a couple of great lines, there were a couple of great moments. I mean, there was so much that we couldn't include, but I conducted a lot of interviews with people who were seminal to the development of the museum and to North Adams over the years, and hours of interviews. I recorded an hour of Bill T. Jones' performance. We recorded a lot of performances at Mass MoCA, and I think that, you know, we have them very well organized, and our intent is to, that archival footage, I think someday we'll probably donate to the museum.
Museum Town is narrated by what we would call cinematic royalty. You have Meryl Streep.
I knew she supported women filmmakers, and I asked her if she would support the film, and she said, what if I'm the narrator? That was like a gift from God. The film wasn't really structured to have a narrator, but she does the voiceover, and she obviously has the most amazing voice. I must say there was so much generosity. I mean, for example, David Byrne had a show at Mass MoCA in 1995, which was 4 years before the museum opened, and it was in a space that it was in the mid-90s, and the spaces were unrenovated. The gallery that was selected for his show, Desire, was picked because the roof didn't leak.
Right, it was the least leaky room.
That's right. And I had home movies. You know, there's a lot of the archival footage are home movies. And he was so generous in, you know, I spent several hours interviewing him recently, and he reflected on that show. And I think it's a great moment that people have to see the film, I guess, to know what that moment is. But it's an example of all the twists and turns and all the unlikely, the happenstance and that happened to bring Mass MoCA into being. At some points, I felt over the years like nobody would believe this because it's just too weird. But there were a lot of twists and turns like that. And certainly his anecdote was emblematic of many of them.
Jennifer Traynor's film Museum Town will be the closing night film at BIFF, screening at the Mehewi in Great Barrington, Massachusetts on Sunday, June 2nd at 7 p.m. BIFFMA.org for ticket information. That's BIFFMA.org. Jennifer, congratulations again on the film, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.